Hi, this is Susie Larson, and thank you so much for listening to Live the Promise today. Our website is filled with even more powerful and encouraging interviews. Learn more by logging on to myfaithradio.com. Good afternoon. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I'm Susie Larson, and this is Live the Promise, and we are here to help you engage in a strong and active walk of faith. Really glad you're listening today. I'm going to have my good friend Ted Cunningham join us back on the show. We're going to talk about the power and the influence of our home built on faith, family, love, communication, and personal responsibility. In fact, Ted writes this. He says, family is where you and I begin to process life. Answering questions is a primary role of a parent and sets the course for a child's life. Parents establish their kids' worldview by answering questions. Questions give parents the opportunity to link faith and family. Let me tell you about my guest, and we'll get him on the show. Ted Cunningham is founder and pastor of Woodland Hills Family Church in Branson, Missouri. His books include Trophy Child and Great Parents, Lousy Lovers, which he co-authored with Gary Smalley. He and his wife, Amy, have two children, and he's got his influencer page up on our website at myfaithradio.com. Pastor Ted, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me, Susie. I always love being on with you.
And you as well. So tell me this. Do you have a verse you've been thinking about these days you can share with us?
The Song of Solomon, chapter 1, verse 4.
And it goes like...
The daughters of Jerusalem are speaking of the young, budding love of Solomon and the Shulamite woman, and they say this: we rejoice and delight in you. We will praise your love more than wine. And that's been a verse I've been meditating on quite a bit lately, because I believe we all, if you claim the name of Christ, you are called to be a backup singer to the duets all around you. And that's in your family, at your work, in your community. And we align, we use here at our church, every marriage is a duet in need of great backup singers.
Wow.
And I want to be someone, everyone I'm come in contact with today, whether it be a single who's contemplating love, relationships, marriage, or a married couple, or someone struggling in marriage, I want to be one that says, we rejoice and delight in you, we will praise your love more than wine. And so what can we do to be better backup singers and good backup singers that people need to turn up, rather than a lot of us have backup singers in our lives that we need to mute altogether.
That is such a great, just a great explanation of that passage and an invitation for us, because we can live such self-focused lives, but to not only put our money where our mouth is and invest in our marriage and our faith and our family, but to look around and be an encouragement to others as well who are also in this journey. I talked to a young man recently whose wife decided that she didn't want to be married anymore, and he was so hurt by his in-laws, and he told her, he said, I want to sit down with your parents and say, you know, on our wedding day, you stood up and you promised to fight for us. Mm. And at the first hint of trouble, you're telling her you want her to be happy, and, you know, you're washing your hands. And he was so deeply hurt by that. And it was a trauma to him as much as losing her, is because he was so sure that they would stand up. And, you know, that is really jarring when the chips are down, so to speak. I mean, we truly do have to stand on the wall for each other, don't we?
Yeah, and parents have a very difficult time, and I understand it. I've experienced it. I don't have children who are married yet, but I know I'm already wanting to practice how to advocate for a marriage and not just my child. And I think parents with adult children, they have a very difficult time advocating for the marriage of their child and not just their child. And like you just shared with that young man, he's longing for parents and for in-laws who say, we will speak blessing over this marriage. We will pray for this marriage. We will encourage you.
We'll fight
for it. We're going to fight for it. Mm-hmm. We're not just going to be an ally for one spouse. We're going to be an ally for both.
And you have been a champion as a pastor. I mean, this has been a hallmark of your ministry. Even you preach on family and marriage, don't you? Like something like every second Sunday of the month?
Yeah, this Sunday is a To Ignite Sunday at our church, and we teach on marriage. I'm doing a message called Rainbows and Unicorns.
Oh, that sounds interesting.
How to face your marriage on facing your marriage on truth, not myths.
Oh, okay.
So,
I get it now. You lost me on the rainbows and unicorns, but I'm with you now. This
is
good.
One is a promise of God, and one is a myth.
Okay, that's
so
perfect.
What are you going to base your marriage on? Yeah.
Love that. Okay, well, here's a quote from
I'm reclaiming the rainbow this week. My goal is for the church to reclaim the rainbow.
There you go. It's God's promise, right? Love that.
Yep.
Okay, here's a quote from your book, The Power of Home, and the subtitle is Taking Charge of Your Faith in Your Family, which I love because it implies such intentionality. But Ted writes, our faith is defined in the home, then displayed to the world. If you want to know the character of a man, a woman, or child, watch them in the home. Taking charge of your faith and family begins with an honest assessment of where you are right now. Say more about that.
Yeah, you know, if you catch me out in public or I catch you out in public and for example, I catch you in a bad moment. Like I catch you where your patience is low. You have nothing left. It's the end of the day. You need to get some groceries quick before you head home. I shouldn't judge everything about your life in that moment. And I'm trying to teach my kids this. I don't know everything that has happened today in Susie Larson's life to bring her to this moment. And so this is one of the reasons why we make bad judges. We should never judge a person by the moment they're in, because we never know everything that led to that moment. Mm-hmm. So if I really want to know Susie Larson, I'm probably going to interview her husband more than just what happened in the grocery store, because your family sees all the moments. They see the good moments, the bad moments, the frustrating moments, the life-giving moments, the defining moments. They see all the moments, and I'm going to have a good picture of Susie Larson from all those moments strung together rather than the last moment. And so there's no place, the workplace, you don't get all the moments. The workplace, you get certain types of moments, but you don't get all of them like you do in the home. So it's in the home that I want to pay attention and find out, okay, what does Carson Cunningham say of me? What does Corinne Cunningham say of me? What does Amy Cunningham say of me? Because they see me in work moments, in lighter moments, in difficult moments, in painful moments, in moments of mourning that we just don't tend to see in one another, you know, out in public or even when I'm speaking or in the church. I mean, you're getting a snapshot, but you're not getting the totality of it. It's in the home that you see it all.
You know, I was going to ask you where you got this sense of intentionality, because I feel like that marks your books and your messages as really being intentional. But I know where you got it, because your parents were actually very intentional with you from just reading your books. So I want you to talk about, I just thought this was so funny. I'm trying to find my question for you, but you actually, yeah, here it is. Your dad, okay, you were 11 years old and you and your dad had a big fight over taxes. First of all, tell us the story. But I love this because I think you contacted the IRS as an 11-year-old. But go ahead and tell us that story.
I don't know if I got to the IRS, but I did get to some tax accountants
of
and
course.
Some attorneys. And
okay.
I don't think a lot of 11-year-olds are fighting their parents today over taxes. But I remember I started working very young and to where I got 1099s at a very young age. And I remember around 10, 11 years old, I got a 1099 that was pretty substantial. I mean, it was thousands and thousands of dollars. And my dad just one night in passing said, hey, Ted, this will be great. I'll do your taxes with you. And I remember stopping at an 11-year-old and in my mind thinking, what is he talking about? And I could tell deep down my dad had no greater joy than to sit down and do a 1040 short form with me. I think it was the 1040 EZ. Hmm. And he said, I'm going to do your taxes with you because technically this 1099 means you're self-employed. And I said, what does that mean? He said, well, you got to pay all of your Social Security tax. I wish you could see the look on my face, but it was just like, what are you talking about? No one would make an 11-year-old pay taxes. And my dad said, oh, son, welcome to the real world, which is a parent's favorite line. I don't know when parents get that line, but I know the use of it is something they desire to use regularly. And I set out on a journey to convince my dad that the government would never expect an 11-year-old to pay taxes. And it frustrated my dad that I wouldn't take his word for it. So I started calling accountants and attorneys, and you know what I found out? My dad was right.
Go figure.
And sometimes as parents, right, we get frustrated when our kids don't believe us, but sometimes they need to go on another journey to find out we were right. And for some parents, that may be in the 20s or the 30s that the kid comes back. And what's the old saying? The older I get, the smarter my parents get.
Amen. You know,
right?
I'm picturing this accountant going, and you're how old? You know, I want to ask about this.
And I'm trying to figure out, I don't remember the conversation, but I'm wondering if he explained to me the definition of retainer. You know, before I answer your questions, young
exactly.
Theodore, you need to send me $500.
Exactly. Oh, that is so funny. And I think your tax bill is something like $1,500. How does an 11-year-old get to that? But I'll tell you how. I'm going to read this quote from your book. I loved it. You said, as early as I can remember, my parents told my brother and me, we're going to provide you with three things, food, clothing, and shelter. That's our responsibility as parents. Gifts come on holidays and birthdays. If you want extras, you need to earn them. You need to get out there and work. And then you said, they didn't start this off right away. They waited till I was 6 before they made me earn. At 6 years old, I had a wallet and cash. You had a wallet and cash at 6 years old. So you made enough money at 11 to owe something like $1,500 in taxes. I mean, that's intentionality.
Yeah, I dug ditches at our church. My pastor thought it would be better. I put this in the book. He thought it would be better instead of renting a thing called a ditch witch, which is a piece of equipment you can go down to the rental company and rent. He thought it would be better to hire all the junior high boys to do it. And I look back on even that, as much as I picked on my pastor and my preaching, he could have saved a lot of money by hiring that one guy with a ditch witch to dig all these ditches, because we had to get some. Well, you're in Minnesota. You know this. I mean, the frost line is like 2 or 3 feet. I can't remember. But we had to dig deep ditches for these drainage pipes. And he had the junior high boys out there, pay them an hourly wage to do it. And then that just led into other jobs and a 1099, that 15. And my dad had no greater joy than to go down to the bank when I was 11 and take out $1,500 out of my account to pay that bill. And a joke I can't get away with in a political season, but he said, Ted, you're going to discover quickly as you pay these taxes, it's going to impact your voting one day.
True words were never spoken.
I'm not going to say what he really said, but I'm sure you can understand what he probably really said.
Absolutely. He's a boy. I want to talk to him someday. All right, we're talking to Ted Cunningham. When we come back, we're going to look at some marriage and family trends that are very interesting. One is the kid-centered home, prolonged adolescence, delayed marriage, and more like that. You've got questions, now is the time to call 877-933-2484 or email me, Susie@myfaithradio.com. We're with Ted Cunningham in a moment. Tuning in today, I'm Susie Larson. This is The Promise, talking to my friend Ted Cunningham. He's an author and a pastor. And boy, if there's one word that would mark just what I know of Ted from interviewing him over the years and reading his books, it's intentionality. And that really marks my life too, Ted. I'm motivated by that, because I think the best things that are worth having are worth fighting for and going after. And you were raised that way, and I think you pastor and write that way. Really appreciate that. Let's look at some of the marriage and family trends that you address when you're out and about speaking. And I'm thinking it makes people stop in their tracks. Because some of these, I think, just sort of came upon us without us realizing it. But talk about the kid-centered home and why this is a dangerous trend.
Yeah, I think the last time we were with you, we got through half of them, didn't we?
We
ran out of time. I do talk a lot about the kid-centered trend, the kid-centered home trend, because, and I wrote about it in The Power of Home, I did a whole book on it in the Trophy Child, where I talk about the vanity parent, where we use our attributes and the attributes and accomplishments of our children to try to impress other people. And it came about in the 80s, where we just became more nurturing. It was a knee-jerk reaction to our parents who, you know, many of us were raised with a speak when spoken to, you know, be seen, not heard. And so we just moved more towards that nurturing, let's go ahead and make the whole home about the child. And in doing so, we've created an environment where children really aren't prepared for the world. They get out, they're frustrated with college professors, deans, first bosses for not treating them as their parents treated them. And I've been reading a lot of articles even lately on this about the struggle of Generation Y trying to fit into the workplace, but they're just frustrated because they want points for showing up. Like, I want credit for being here. And instead of going into a workplace and saying, you know, how can I add value to you? We've adapted this mindset out of the kid-centered home, and children out of the kid-centered home kind of walk into work and are like, hey, aren't you blessed to have me here? And that's really what the kid-centered home did. And so instead of gratefulness, we have entitlement. We have, I receive gold stars and A's for showing up and for attempting, rather than for accomplishing and producing. And so mom and dad are struggling. They let their marriage suffer in the home to provide extra special opportunities to our extra special children. And mom and dad have just kind of fallen for this idea that our job as parents is to provide our children with every opportunity. So we put them in everything, every sport, every activity, every academic pursuit we can find for them, because we want them to be awesome at everything. And, you know, I write about this quite a bit in The Power of Home. That's not how I was raised. My mom and dad realized we don't have the time or the money for you to try everything, to do everything. So we need to help you find things that are suited for who you are. And if we find something you're not good at, as good parents, we're going to tell you that. And I didn't, you know, I think some of the cruelest parents on the planet are those that stand outside the audition hall of American Idol. And it took three judges to tell a young person you can't sing. And I always think about the fact, man, that's why you have parents. Mom and dad should have told you you couldn't sing before paying money to send you to Chicago for an audition. Mm. And you'd be told you can't sing, and no amount of you know, auditions or, you know, vocal lessons is going to make you a great singer.
Yep.
you need to pursue something else. And I think that's part of the tragedy of the kid-centered home is,
yeah,
we told kids, do whatever you want, but that's really not what we're taught in the scripture. I am created in Christ Jesus to do good works, which he prepared in advance for me to do. Healthy parents help children find what those good works that God has gone out before and prepared for our children, rather than let's make you awesome at everything.
So, Ted, would you say, have you noticed, is one parent more prone than the other to be child-centered? My guess is it's the mom because we're such nurturers, but have you seen that be an even split, or has it mostly been towards moms?
Well, I think that the kid-centered home has taken dad out of the role of disciplinarian. I think dad is softer on discipline today because of the over-nurturing and the over-protecting and the making every child extra special. And the reason I put the kid-centered home trend at the top of the list is because think about a husband and a wife both being raised in a kid-centered home. Now they're trying to do married life in their 20s and 30s. And mom and dad told them the whole time how special they are, how extra special they are, how they can do whatever they want. And now you've got two, and, you know, it's two becoming one is the goal of marriage. But now what do you do with two children who've been given a false sense of personhood?
Yeah.
Trying to become one. You know, they've been told, my mom and dad told me this. And, well, I got to be honest with you, a lot of what your mom and dad told you, it wasn't true.
Hmm. You're just not
true.
All that. And then you've got 2-year-olds and 1-year-olds who are going,
right.
they're not parent-centered. But I would almost think that the parents have been child-centered. They still would want their lives to be me-centered, and kids seem to disrupt that when they're little babies and toddlers. You know what I mean? You know what I'm saying?
They yeah, and 100%. And the kid-centered home is what moved into that next trend, which is prolonged adolescence. It never required of children, that you need to grow up. You need to go from being a boy to being a man, from being a woman, from being a girl to being a woman. It's time for you to make the decision to take responsibility. And, so with a 10 and a 12-year-old, it's everything I can do every day to add responsibility to them and to say, hey, I need you to step up in this area. I need you to take responsibility for this. I need you to learn how to set an alarm clock and get yourself up. We saw a movie this weekend, and, it was a 27-year-old who couldn't find a place to stay. Mom and Dad finally said, you need to get out of the house. And so he ends up staying with an older guy for a period of time, just to help him out. And asked this man, is it too much to ask for you to wake me up every morning? And the guy's like, I ain't your mama. Right? It's time. You're in your 20s now. You should be able to get yourself up out of bed and take that little bit of responsibility for your life. And so imagine, we tell young people getting married, she ain't your mama, so don't treat your wife like your mama. But if you were raised in a kid-centered home, there are going to be some subtle expectations there of her to treat you with the extra specialness that your mom did.
Yeah.
Instead of, hey, we're husband and wife now. It's not son and mom in this relationship. So if you don't want her treating you like your mom, don't put those expectations on her.
So, Ted, we've got about a minute and a half before we have to take a break, so feel free to carry the answer to the other side of the break. But we need to start preparing our kids when they're in their young teens then, and not just our sons. I mean, someone once said that young men are like trucks. They drive better with a heavy load. It's good for them to have a weight of responsibility. But there's got to be ways that we prepare both our young women and sons, our young daughters and sons, to say, when you turn, to start weaning them off of their dependence on us. So you got now about a minute before we take a break. So touch on that, if you would, and we'll pick it up on the other side. How do you prepare these kids to launch, even early on, where you start to program them a little bit?
Yeah, it's what we tell our kids. You won't be with mom and dad forever, so plan accordingly. You need to know, and I say this to our kids in jest, but they know I'm serious, that I tell them, hey, listen, you won't be with mom and dad forever. We love you. You're a welcomed addition to this home, but you need to know when you leave home, your mom and I, we got big plans. and they at first they would rebel against it, but I picked my daughter up today from school. And she said, hey, I'd love to go to Mama and Papa's tonight. If you want to drop us off, it'd be cool if you and Mom had a date. And I'm going, okay, that now I even have children who are fighting for our marriage.
Nice.
And who understand the value of Mom and Dad having quality couple time.
And she also has your negotiating skills because she made that work for her. You guys go ahead and have a date. I got a place I got to be, too. Just saying. Talking to Ted Cunningham. When we come back, I want to hear more from Ted about how to prepare these adolescent young teens to have a mindset to launch so that they can have a healthy launch to kind of undo that prolonged adolescent trend. More with Ted Cunningham when we come back.
There's a war between guilt and grace. They're fighting for a sacred space. But I'm living through. Grace wins every time.
Well, I hope you're having a fantastic day. I'm Suzy Larson. This is Live the Promise, talking to my friend Ted Cunningham. He's a pastor in Branson, and he's an author. The title of this latest book is The Power of Home: Taking Charge of Your Faith and Your Family. As I said this before the break, what I love about Ted is his intentionality when it comes to fighting for marriage, fighting for family, cultivating an atmosphere of growth and faith. And we're talking about some of the trends that Ted has identified that we're seeing in our culture today, even among Christians. We talked about the kid-centered home, and we've done whole shows on that before, talking also about prolonged adolescence. And just the question I posed before the break, Ted, I'd love for you just to unpack a bit. For those, I mean, I love that you're saying to your kids, you're not always going to live here. You're going to launch, so plan accordingly. What are some other ways that parents can communicate to kids that you won't be, you know, sitting in our basement playing video games when you're 30, maybe really preparing them to launch and maybe weaning them off of dependence on us? What does that look like in a healthy way?
Yeah, it's picturing a special future for our kids and their marriage and their work and getting behind work like you get behind their, you know, other projects, other school projects, academics, athletics, and saying, hey, work is important, and the skills, and I talk about this, the longest chapter in The Power of Home is the correlation between work and relationships and the value of responsibility in the workplace, and what you need to be prepared for to do work is the same preparation you need for relationships, the same responsibility. And so, you know, for us, we a couple things. We pray with our kids about their future spouses. We talk about what their future spouses would look like. Our joke right now in our family, we sing the song a lot together. You don't have to be lonely at farmersonly.com. And then Carson usually finishes it by saying, city folks just don't get it. Because my 12-year-old daughter, Corinne, she's an old soul. So she, you know, on the way driving her home, she was knitting. She knits and crochets every day. She wants to grow the vegetables so she can can them.
Wow.
I bought her one of those sets that, you know, you light the wax and you put your family's, you know, the letter C on. I'm actually sending an electric bill out in the mail this week with a wax seal on it that has C on it. I mean, so anything that's old, she wants to make new again.
Very
and
cool.
And she's a farmer. She's a rancher. And so I joke with her about, you're probably going to marry a farmer one day or a rancher one day, aren't you? And she goes, I don't know, Dad. But that leads into a conversation with, hey, Corinne, I want you to know, I'd be great if you married a farmer. It'd be great if you married a rancher. And she looks at me like, are you sure? And I said, to me, and you've heard me talk about this when we talked about Young and in Love on your show, the character of the man you marry is way more important to me than the competency of the man, meaning how hard he works is way more important than what he does. Mm. And again, it's little conversations like that that you start getting into your kids' hearts to say, okay, my dad, he will bless a marriage to a guy who has a full-time job. And, you know, don't bring a guy home to me from college who's keeping his options open, right? Or don't bring home the guy who is holding out for a management position. Bring me the guy who detassels corn in the summer or whatever he needs to do. Bring home the guy that, you know, on Christmas break shoveled snow. I talk about that in the book. I mean, just bring home the guy who has filled his college years with odd jobs to make money rather than just sitting around doing nothing. And, I mean, that shows the character of a guy. That shows me a guy who's going to do anything he has to do to provide for his family if something were to fall apart or his industry that he goes into falls apart or, you know, if he's a farmer or rancher, what he does isn't as important. And that's become a game with Corinne and I. She'll see things going on or the waiter will come up to the table and she'll go, how about that, Dad? What if I marry a waiter? I'm like, well, first of all, you have no idea what that waiter's story. This may be a second or third job providing for a family of five. And I said, and for that reason, I really like that guy. I mean, I make up stories about people all the time to say, this is what's the most important thing. And I just think as parents, we're so messed up on this. We don't know how to separate, you know, character from competency anymore. I think I shared this story years ago on your show, but, you know, when I brought home failing grades in math to my engineer parents. And I just remember my dad never got frustrated with me when I brought home bad grades in math and when I brought home papers that had more of the teacher's ink than my ink on them, you know. And I asked my dad years later, why did you never get bothered? He said, we realized early on in your schooling that God didn't give you a math brain. And so we realized it wasn't a character issue because you studied harder for math than you did all your other subjects combined. But what do the parents today, what do we do today if our kid brings home bad grades in math? We don't know how to separate character and competency. We just assume something's wrong, so let's get this child all the help we can get them if they're going to be an engineer. Or what happens if to your 13- or 14-year-old child you realize, okay, this child probably ain't going to be an engineer. We need to pursue other options. And my mom and dad, think about this. My mouth got me in so much trouble in school. You can't imagine, can you? But I go, Dad, what about that? And he goes, your mom and I prayed that God would one day redeem your mouth.
Wow.
And I go, that's sad for me today, parents, that don't – I mean, think about the thing that could be getting your kid in trouble right now at school, maybe the thing God uses to turn into a career one day.
But we won't see that if we fit them into our mold. You know what I mean? It's like, well
– No, absolutely.
You know, the other thing I was thinking about is, you know, Corinne talking about these potential mates and these hard workers. If you're not cultivating that work ethic in the home with your own kids, they're not going to esteem it when they see it in somebody else. Do you know what I'm saying? And so what you're saying here is you want to esteem that very thing that we're working so hard to build in you.
Hey, and that's – so that when – you know, we got 9 chickens – that Corinne has that, you know, give us fresh eggs every day.
Are you very serious? And you have 9 chickens?
Yes, absolutely. We had 11, but I don't want to say
okay.
There's all sorts of issues raising chickens, but if there's ever a morning I go, hey, Corinne, go feed the chickens or go clean out the chicken pen, if there's ever a moment of hesitation, like, oh, no, not now, Dad, or if I sense that in her, and I'll bring it back to marriage and relationships often, I'll say, hey, that guy's never going to ask you to be his wife if you have a problem with cleaning out a chicken coop. You've got to be willing to clean out the chicken coop. And so you talk about preparing teens for marriage one day. Most parents never talk about marriage with their teens because they want their teens to hold off marriage as long as possible. I think part of picturing a special future for your kids is making it a regular conversation in the home.
Wow.
So that they know, hey, my parents talk to me about this a lot. And so it's not a surprise at 22 when someone knocks on the door and says, hey, I'm interested in your daughter, Mr. Cunningham. Would you be open to me, you know, dating her? Would you be open to me marrying her? You know, we've had plenty of conversations. That's not when the conversations start. It starts when they're very young.
So identifying this other trend of delayed marriage, what is the reason behind that? Is part of it because nobody's been talking about that because of the prolonged adolescence? It's just kind of another wave and ripple effect of where we're at right now?
Yeah, and one researcher puts it this way. Marriage to Generation Y and towards the tail end of Generation X has become the capstone rather than the cornerstone, meaning marriage is what we do when we've done everything else. You know, and I had this quote in the book that, you know, no matter what you read in the paper or what research shows, marriage has not caused a single divorce. You know, young people today are like, if I don't have my life in order, a good job, which we've already talked about that, they're delaying getting full-time jobs and waiting for the perfect job to come along or one that fits their degree. And so they need a job, they need some money, they need their first place, they need all their education, they need all that accomplished. And once all that's accomplished, then we'll put the capstone on, which is marriage. And that's just not how it's been through most of history and traditionally and biblically. It's like marriage was something you did as part of the adulthood process, not at the end of it.
And it's a great thing to work it out together. I mean, when you integrate all those things together and you're learning unselfishness and commitment and perseverance, it's a character builder.
Being poor together is one of the best character builders.
Indeed.
You know, Amy and I, we talk about it all the time. It's like, do you remember some of the issues we had when we had to make decisions, right? Mm-hmm. You know, getting in our first place and deciding, yes, we can get a washer and dryer, or we could get a second car. Do we want to drive one car and take each other to work and drop each other off, or do we want to go to a laundromat? And it's like those are the decisions that help us build our character together and two becoming one. And it's the longer you stay single and the longer you hold off marriage, you get very comfortable making those decisions on your own. And so one of the lies out there is that you'll be better at marriage the longer you are independent. And I'm going, well, yep. The goal of marriage is two becoming one. Do you want two totally independent, live on your own, by yourself, for yourself, people coming together and try to have a marriage, that's a challenge when you've learned how to live by yourself and for yourself for a decade, and now we're going to try to come together and become one. I'm not saying you can't do it. You definitely can do it, but I think it's more challenging.
And those days of grilled cheese or tomato soup, I mean, when you're working that out together, they become very sweet and treasured memories when you're working it out together. I mean, there's so much to that. Okay, sliding versus deciding. We touched on this one last time you were on, and it seems to just ripple out of these other ones, but talk about that one.
Yeah, that is Scott Stanley from the University of Denver. It's actually the title of his blog, Sliding versus Deciding, and it's on relationship formation. I've applied it to almost every area of my life now, ministry, home, you know, decision-making, the lack of margin in my life. So, you know, decisions have power, and if we want to be successful in relationships, we need to make solid decisions. So in traditional relationship formation, you saw someone you were interested in, you asked them on a date, you made the decision you wanted to marry them, so you involved other people in the decision, you got dad's permission, you set a date, you know, that's traditional relationship formation. But then sliding is, we're not going to make any decisions, and years later we're going to be like, how did we get here? And obviously that's, you know, cohabitation is the primary example of that. Went on a date, we liked it, went on a second date, third date, we, you know, ended up being together physically, and then after being together physically a few times, it didn't make sense for me to get up and go back home. I just spent the night, and then I, you know, didn't make sense to get up in the morning and go home and get ready for work. I asked for a drawer. I ended up with a drawer at my girlfriend's place, and then I ended up with part of the closet, and then lease was coming up. And so, okay, now there's a lease. What do we want to do? Do we sign it together? Do you sign it? Then we go to Walmart, and there's a truck backed up in the parking lot that's giving away puppies. We decide to get a puppy together. I mean, so we're not making any decisions. We're just sliding past all the traditional relationship formation decisions, and we end up in a lease, in an apartment, with a puppy going, how did we get here? Well, and that's sliding.
Wow. And you think there's so much loss when the lines are so blurred that way, and yet it happens every single day in the day that we're in. When we come back, we're going to talk about those last two trends, dating while divorcing and graying divorce, and more about the power of home, how we can be intentional and build faith and family at home. Don't go away. More with Ted Cunningham in a moment. Hope you're having a great day today. Really glad to have you listening. I'm Susie Larson. This is Live the Promise, talking about being super intentional at home, taking charge of your faith and your family. That's the subtitle of Ted Cunningham's new book, The Power of Home. We've been walking through six marriage and family trends that are, you know, concerning, and Ted speaks about these often when he travels around the country. We've touched on the kid-centered home, prolonged adolescence, delayed marriage, sliding versus deciding. So interesting. And as I was saying before the break, we lose so much when you're just sliding into these different life stages, you know, as a couple that's dating and all the lines get blurred, when those are supposed to really be landmark decisions together, to be celebrated, to be invited to, as, you know, as you're walking with God. I mean, there's a lot of loss involved, isn't there?
Yeah. And I think everyone can relate to sliding versus deciding from a time perspective and from margin in our lives. You know, we say yes to everything, and great opportunities hit us all the time, and we go, yeah, well, sure, I'll do that. Yeah, sure. Yeah. And then you get to a point where you're pulling your hair out going, how did I get here?
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you how you got there. You didn't make decisions. You slid into everything you said yes to. You slid into, yeah, I'll do the parent-teacher thing. Yeah, I'll do that project at school. Yeah, the church needs more of this. Yeah, this, then I'll, yeah. And if you notice successful people, they've made the decisions on what they will say yes to and what they will say no to. And that is their filter for making all decisions. And it's decided before opportunities present themselves. So for young people, put that in the context of relationship formation, make your decisions early. And this is what I'm doing. Like, you know, we had the conversation before the break with Corinne. You know, I as a dad now with a 12-year-old daughter can begin giving her those filters, those decision, you know, markers to say, okay, when I get asked out on a date one day, I know what I say yes to, I know what I say no to. And, you know, I mean, one of them will be, there's no way my dad's going to approve of this if you ain't got a job.
Yeah, if you're holding out for management. Let's just save ourselves some time.
If you got fired because you wanted your birthday off, this isn't going to go good with my dad. I just need you to
know
that right now.
I already know the answer to this one. That's hilarious. Okay, here's one that's so concerning, dating while divorcing. But I read this in your book, and I thought, that is happening. I mean, you see it, and Christians are justifying it and posting about it even. It's kind of curious. What do you say?
Yeah, this is the social media trend that we're seeing more. And I never was prepared for this in college or seminary. I'm hoping seminaries are teaching this now, but no pastoral class could prepare me for meeting with a couple, and now I need to ask the question at the beginning of the session, are a husband and wife, I'm meeting with a husband and wife, are either one of you dating anyone else? Or if this marriage doesn't work out, do you know who you will be dating?
Wow.
And they, yes. And the reason you have to ask that question up front is because if I'm here fighting for the reconciliation of this marriage and one or both of you are not, we're not going to get anywhere.
Mm.
We're just going to be wasting time. And so I think the thing, now this goes back to the verse at the beginning of the broadcast. We rejoice in delighting you, we will praise your love more than wine. So we spent about the last year helping our congregation become great backup singers to their family and friends. Like, what do you do when you get the phone call that, hey, we're getting a divorce? What do you say and what do you do? Because we have discovered that many Christians don't have a clue what to say or do when their brother or sister calls them and says, hey, my marriage is over. Well, you need counseling. Let's get you with somebody who can help you. No, you're the front line. You're the first person they called. So there's obviously a level of trust built there. So here's the opposite side of that. I'm preaching and teaching hard all year how to be a great backup singer. And I hear of a couple getting a divorce in our community, and the divorce is not final. This is the key to this trend. The like divorce papers maybe haven't even been started yet, but they're separated. And a week or two later, there's a new profile picture on Facebook with the new boyfriend or the new girlfriend. That hits me kind of hard. But what shatters me is when members of our church who have sat under sound teaching, sound biblical teaching, start hitting the like button on that new picture. And I'm just going, whoa, slow it way down. Think about the children. Think about the family and friends. And this is the line I use, and it's in the book. Please don't ask me to celebrate your new marriage or your new relationship while I'm still mourning the death of your last one.
Yeah, amen.
That's part of the problem with this trend. It's divorce is death. And that's why I'm not into this. I can't grasp this new selfie picture thing. You're supposed to take husband and wife. Once you're divorced, you're supposed to step outside the courthouse now and take a picture of yourselves happy.
Right.
I don't know if you've seen that. And I'm going, no. This is death. This is death. And we have humor and laughter at many of our funerals if we're celebrating a life well lived. But I use the example often in teaching. It's having a new relationship within weeks of the old one is like bringing a date to your spouse's funeral. We all would look at that and say, that is odd. That is weird. Think about your children. Don't come walking in holding hands with another woman or another man while we're mourning the death of your spouse. The same thing with your marriage. Please do not ask us to start celebrating and hitting the like button on social media of a new relationship when you're still married to this woman or you're still married to this man.
Oh, my goodness. When you step back, I mean, even think about the children involved and what that must feel like to them and how jarring it must be and confusing. And the thing is, and this is probably a whole other show, Ted, but it's like the answer to your marriage troubles isn't just getting another person. I mean, you've got baggage to sort through. You were a part of something that fell apart. There's so much work to do before you're even ready to consider dating. But yet this happens over and over again, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I want to show folks the happiness you're experiencing in the new relationship is more than possible in the current relationship.
Yeah.
In the marriage that's not yet dissolved, or in the marriage that legally is still binding. It's possible. Right now, you've been so miserable for so long, you want to break from it. And so this is one of the ways to be a great backup singer. You've got to slow folks down. And I have to say this and remind folks of this. Please, in the middle of this, guard your hearts from another relationship. Stay off of social media. Let me tell you, the worst place to heal from a divorce, do not try to heal from a divorce on social media.
Amen.
Empty and heartbreaking and devastating if you measure likes. Those likes aren't real. Those likes are passive moments of, let me just give my friend a shot in the arm to say, you know, I love him. Listen, if you're looking for validation in the likes from pictures, it's going to leave you as empty as the stuck marriage that you're in right now is leaving you. There's a deeper issue going on, and dating while divorcing is not going to solve that.
Wow. Okay, and this final one, graying divorce. We touched on it last time, but I'd love for you just to unpack it a bit more.
Well, you know, and I tell folks, just when you thought grandma and grandpa's marriage has to be the last safe marriage in culture, and certainly, you know, the only thing about talking about these trends sometimes is if this is a sermon or a full broadcast, people can kind of walk away going, wow, I am really, got a little spark in my step from that, Mr. Doomsday Pastor. But, you know, and I tell them after we've shared the first five trends, people are like, okay, yeah, we're pretty in bad shape. And I go, well, don't just wait. Remember, we got grandma and grandpa's, mm-hmm. but that's the last trend is graying divorce. 50 years ago, the divorce rate for those over the age of 50 was like 2.8%. It was almost non-existent. But then it crept up in 1990 to 1 in 10, which 10%, so, you know, quadrupled. And then now they're telling us it's about 28%, or, you know, just over 1 in 4 marriages of those over the age of 50 end in divorce. So that's where we get the term graying. It's senior adults divorcing. And, you know, so the last place we were to go to for the model of commitment, you know, the grandma and grandpa, Amy's grandparents, you know, married both sets because of their age and longevity, married 65 years. Mm-hmm. They made it to the 65-year mark. My friends Lloyd and Jean in Iowa City, Iowa, they just last year celebrated 70 years of marriage. And I mean, these are where we go to for the wisdom, for the counsel, for the show us what it means. And I always love to challenge the young people in our congregation. Listen, especially every one of you moms who has antibacterial product hanging off of your purse right now, okay? I want you to go find a grandma in this congregation who let her children pick up cigarette butts and chew on them a little bit, and they were fine. Okay, you need to be reminded your children will make it. You know, dad let the kids drive in the back window of the car, but, you know, you now put them in the car seat like you're launching them into outer space. I mean, times have changed. That overprotective, hovering parent has now, you know, scared to death, and it's bled into the marriage. Now we're concerned our marriage isn't going to make it. You need to go listen to a senior adult couple who has survived, not only survived, but thrived in 40, 50, 60 years of marriage, and let them tell you, you can do this. You can do this. You have great years ahead of you. Don't quit at year 5.
Amen.
Don't quit at year 10. Go the distance. And look forward to the empty nest years. I tell my kids, when you guys leave, your mom and I got big plans. They say, what are you going to do? I say, first thing, we're going to Disney World. We are going to have a ball. They're like, Dad. They know. They know my heart.
You got to come back, and I promise we'll jump over those trends and get into more of the intentionality. But I wanted to cover them. I'm so sorry, but it was so good. And we've gone right up to the mark here. But will you please come back next month, and we can continue on this conversation?
I would love to. Thank you, Susan.
Love to do that. There's so much good stuff in this book. But either way, hear us. Be intentional. be intentional about cultivating faith and family in the home. Pursue your mate, love your spouse, raise your kids up to leave and to be successful outside of your care. So glad you tuned in today. I'm Susie Larson. This is Live the Promise. In just a bit, you'll find podcasts from my conversation with Ted up on our website at myfaithradio.com. You can send it out by a click of a button by Facebook, email, Twitter. I pray that you're encouraged today and meet us back here next time. Have a blessed evening.